Okay, we're carrying on this series, obviously, understanding and engaging the world, and beginning to move, hopefully tonight, slightly further on from just understanding how the world around us works, and particularly how idols work and the way they preach to us, into somewhat more, how do we start to engage them, okay, the world around us. So that's kind of where we're going. I'm taking it as read as well that for all of us, a common problem is that whilst we know we should share our faith, and even that we'd like to, we just find it massively difficult. Now, there's all sorts of reasons why we find evangelism difficult, but one of the prime ones is it's just even getting started, like the first conversation. It feels sometimes almost impossible to actually get talking about anything serious or get talking about the gospel. And particularly if you're a conservative evangelical and you've got a good grip on the gospel and you know that Christ died for our sins, that he took God's wrath in our place, that if you don't turn to God, you'll suffer hell. That just seems miles away from any kind of conversation we have day to day. So what I hope we'll do over the next couple of weeks is basically try and work out some ways of bridging that gap between what we know of the gospel, which is kind of over here, and my life day to day over here. Now, there's no magic answers. If there was magic answers, someone would have thought of them a long time ago. And if there was some secret key that you could just look at one evening and it would make the whole thing a doddle, well, you know, it's unlikely to have been discovered by me this week, having been hidden for 2,000 years to the church. But I think there are some things that help sort of cross that bridge, as it were, between our life and the gospel that we want to take to the people in our lives. Just by way of recap there, I know some people come alternate week. So the first week we saw this fact, which should be helpful to us, that actually everybody, whether they're Christian or not, knows the real God. Okay, they suppress the truth, but they know the real God deep down there. They suppress that knowledge and turn to serve idols. So you've got two things going on. There's a sort of battle in their own minds. They know God, but they're serving an idol. Okay, so that's a sort of non-Christian mindset. We also saw last week that these idols that we serve, be it money or sex or power or whatever, just like any God, have messages, have gospels they preach to us to attract us in. And that's really what we looked at last week. The fact that those messages that they preach, these false gospels, are kind of imitations of the real gospel. So they promise us a heaven. You know, if only you get a wife, then you'll be happy. That'll be paradise, that sort of thing. So just down there on the sheet again, the help basically off the back of those last 2 weeks is that basically people can never escape the truth that's written into them and that's written in the world around them, that something isn't right. So everybody feels the need to be saved. Okay, they might not use that word, but they know something's not right in their life. They're not living in happy ever after land. They're not living in paradise. They know something needs to change. They might not use religious language like saving, but they know that something needs to happen. And also that the categories of the gospel are already there in people's minds, or the category of something to live for, the category of a paradise, a perfect world. It's there. It's just that the non-Christians have substituted in wrong things. Okay, so the categories are there. It's just the content is all wrong. And whilst that's a discouragement in that everybody's serving a false god, it's also something of an encouragement in that there are points of contact between us as Christians believing a gospel and living for a god, and your non-Christian family or friends or whatever who are also living for a god and believing a gospel. Content different, categories basically the same. So, moving on then, we're just going to look first, and hopefully pretty briefly, because I hope this is familiar ground, at the structure of the gospel, the biblical gospel. If you were asked to explain the gospel, I think we did this a couple of weeks ago, the chances are that everybody, even though we were all Christians and all understand the gospel, would give a slightly different explanation of it. And that's natural. If you think of the just dozens of different ways that the gospel's presented in the Bible, you look at Romans, where it's very sort of legal language about you're sinners, you've broken God's law, you need to be justified, which is a kind of court setting. And then on the other hand, you have Jesus saying, come to me all who are weary and heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Come and eat, I'm the bread of life. He who eats me will never hunger and drinks will never thirst. Although it's the same gospel, they don't contradict, just the way of presenting it is massively different. So it's often compared to a diamond with lots of different sides. They all harmonise with one another. There's not seven different gospels hidden in the Bible. There's only one gospel, but lots of perspectives on it. And I think one helpful way of trying to sort out those perspectives a little bit is thinking about it in terms of those curses of Genesis 3. You remember when Adam and Eve sin, God comes and pronounces curses on the serpent, curses on man and woman, and so on. So just looking at the little diagram there, the first diagram on the sheet, the three problems that come in as a result of the fall have to do with three things. They have to do with God, they have to do with the world, and they have to do with us. So in terms of God, after the fall, so after we sin, God is obviously angry. In terms of the world, because of the fall, because of sin, the world is messed up. So there's thorns and thistles. By the sweat of your brow, you'll work it. Childbirth is difficult. All those sort of pictures that you get in Genesis 3. And in terms of us, well, obviously, man is now fallen. We're punished. The relationship with God is gone, and we're no longer the perfect being we should have been. And therefore, when the gospel comes in, it corrects each of those problems. So again, it solves the problem with God, if I can put it that way. The problem with God is fundamentally that his glory has been defamed and he's angry. So what does the cross do? It propitiates, it turns aside God's anger. The problem with the world is that it's ruined and broken and threatening. Ultimately, what does the gospel do? Well, ultimately, it will transform the world into a paradise, a new creation. And with us, what's the problem? Well, we're under the curse too. We're ruined, we're spoiled, we're destroyed. What does the gospel do? It rescues human beings, restores them, saves them. And obviously, each of those is linked. How do I put it on the sheet? It's not possible, for instance, for the world to be sorted out unless God's anger is sorted out. Okay, the two are inextricable. Likewise, you can't have a human being who's fully rescued unless one day God sorts the world out too. So these things are perspectives on the gospel. They're not different gospels or separate. You can't have one without the others. Now, if you're a conservative Christian or an evangelical, however you want to phrase it, you'll be good and you'll have been taught, hopefully, drummed into your head, to emphasise, be really clear on the fact that there's no salvation, no rescue, no gospel, no good news, unless God's wrath is propitiated. Propitiated just means turned aside. But, just over the page, that tends to leave us with a problem. And the problem is that most people, most non-Christians, do not care about that. And it's incredibly hard for most of us to engineer a conversation about the fact that God's wrath needs turning aside. Occasionally you get people who are just evangelistic geniuses, who seem to be able to sit next to the sort of classic story about being able to sit next to someone on a train and strike up a conversation, and by the time you got from Derby to Leicester, the guy's repented and believed on his knees and is sharing the gospel with the next guy on the train. If that's you, basically, enjoy your drink and go home, or come and sit here. Very few people are like that. Very few people are like that. I'm certainly not like that. And they're one in a million. That may say more about us than the problem, but either way, in reality, it just doesn't happen. And also, you'll be aware that very rarely does anyone come up to you and just say, look, can you explain the gospel to me? Or, I feel that God's angry with me. Is that right? What can be done? If you remember the story in Acts, the Philippian jailer, where the apostles are in prison and the angel comes and lets them out, and the jailer falls to his knees and says, tell me, what must I do to be saved? That has never happened to me, and I imagine may well never happen. So those on-the-plate opportunities, I take it we're kind of okay at taking. Okay, if it does happen, hopefully we've got something at least of the gospel to be able to share. But that Godward, so the sort of that top part of the triangle, part of the gospel, is the hardest to get to. Likewise, I think for most of us, it's relatively rare for people to be able to talk about this bottom right corner, the stuff about the world. I think this comes up somewhat more often. Why is the world such a mess? How can we sort the world out? It comes up particularly with people who are interested perhaps in the environment and green issues, or world aid, or maybe politicians who are trying to sort of sort things out, people in caring professions perhaps. So somewhat more often is how can we sort the troubles of the world out? But even that is pretty rare. Maybe I'll just hang around with selfish people, but my experience at least is that that's quite rare. And by far the most common is the personal dimension. How can I make my life better? So people are not happy, or they're dissatisfied, or they're worried and panicking, or they feel guilty, or they're just angsty about their own lives. And that, because each of us cares about our own lives, and each of us is inherently selfish, I guess, by far the most, I think, gospel opportunities come off the back of these kind of questions, rather than direct questions about God or direct questions about the world. And so they provide the best opportunities, I think, and the best contact points. And what we're going to do this evening is really think about how we move from people's dissatisfaction with life. Things haven't worked out how I'd like them to. I'm not happy, basically. How we can start thinking about moving from there to the gospel. How do we use those opportunities? Okay, so far, that's mostly introductory. Good. Okay, so next on the sheet then, the gospel and my experience. If idols have false gospels, like we saw last time, part of that, the message of those gospels is going to be about my experience, because part of the real gospel's message is about my experience, how to make my life better. And an idol tells me that my life will be better if I come and give my life to its service. So we're going to think through how those claims work. We'll do some specific examples in a minute. But first of all, we're going to look at the actual gospel. Okay, until you know what the real thing is, it's hard to analyse the copy. So what does the real gospel offer me personally, in terms of really my experience of the gospel, okay, my life experience? Well, it's a reversal of those curses again in Genesis 3. It sorts problems with God. It sorts my problems with God. It sorts my problems with the world. And it sorts my problems with mankind or myself. But what we're going to focus in on is my experience of these problems. Okay, my experience of the problems with man. My experience of my problems with God. My experience of my problems with the world. So basically, if you look over the page, at the big diagram, diagram one there at the top is the one that's on the front page. That's a sort of summary of the whole gospel. It sorts out God, it sorts out the world, it sorts out me. And what we're doing is zooming in on that bottom left-hand corner. And we're looking at our experience of the gospel. Don't worry about diagram two too much yet. But it's that little corner that we're zooming in on. And I think what the Bible tells us is actually there are every human being has common experiences. Because we're made in the image of God, and because we're made to relate to God and to the world and to ourselves, when these things go wrong, every human being, doesn't matter whether they're Muslim, materialist, doesn't matter whether they're living for pleasure, sex, power, Hindu, whatever, everybody has the same basic needs, okay? The same basic ways of thinking about the world. So everybody, whatever they profess to believe or not, on those three bullet points there, everybody in relation to God now feels guilt. They might say they don't believe in God, but it's impossible not to feel guilty. We saw that in the Romans 1 passage, that deep down, as Romans 1:32, they know they're doing wrong and yet still approve of it. Romans 2, it talks about our consciences. And if you have honest conversations with people, sometimes they'll admit it, even if they're not admitting they're sinning against God, they know they're not good people. They know they're disobedient, they know they're law-breaking, they know that somehow they are not living as they should. Secondly, because the world's messed up, everybody feels somewhat threatened by the world. They feel insecure in the world. It's a dangerous place, basically. And it might not be physically dangerous, it might not be that I'm going to be killed by something out there in the world, you know, as it is for some people, I guess, in some countries. But it's just that the world's not working for me. You know, I'm the school kid is terrified of going into class because she doesn't fit in. She's not like everybody else. The world frightens her. Or the person at work, it just feels swamped by having to fit into this massive company and feels like there is a tiny sort of nobody in this massive company of people. That just things out there scare us. We feel insecure. And just in and of ourselves, we lack joy. We lack joy. We're not truly happy. Nobody is. No non-Christian is. Well, in reality, no Christian is. We know that because we're meant to find trueness of joy in God. And nothing in creation can give us the same joy as knowing the Lord. Now, the problem is, and we're going to come back to this in a bit, but the problem is, even as Christians, we don't really believe that. Even as Christians, we when you read a Bible verse about
you know, true joy is found in the Lord, you think, oh, well, that's very quaint and everything, but come on. You know, is God really enough to satisfy me? Not really. You know, I need God plus dot, dot, dot. I was reading a book the other day, and it said, it was a John Piper book, he said, could you really be happy? The question to ask yourself is this: could you be happy in heaven if you had a perfect body, never suffering illness again? If you had everybody you're friends with there? If you had every earthly pursuit that you'd ever enjoyed but perfected again in heaven? And if you lived in a perfect world with all the food and pleasures and provisions that your heart could desire, but Christ wasn't there, could you be happy? And actually, for most of us, the instinctive answer is, yeah, that'd be fine. You know, that'd be absolutely fine. And that's sin at work in our hearts. But what we want is the stuff that God can give us. We don't really want God. And so we continue to believe this lie, even as Christians, and obviously non-Christians completely believe it, but even as Christians, we continue to believe the lie that it is stuff in the world that will give us joy, not God. And it's probably the greatest battle for Christian belief. Will I find joy in knowing God, or actually will I find most of my joy in dot, 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 my possessions or my wife or my children? Or so that battle for joy, we know that only true joy can be found in the Lord. And so we also know by default, therefore, that no Christian can be fully happy and satisfied. It's just impossible because they don't have Christ. So the gospel again, just on that last paragraph, and then we'll try and clarify a few things. The gospel again, just focusing on my experience, promises solutions to each of those problems. So in relation to God and my guilt, it promises that I can be forgiven, have a clear conscience. In relation to the world, it promises security. Not because the world will be suddenly made perfect, that won't happen until Christ returns, but because if you become a Christian, God will look after you. Romans 8:28, in all things God will work for the good. Sorry, in all things God works for the good of those who love him. He's not saying that the world is made easy, but he's saying that he will protect you. And even in the bad things of life, so you get ill, or you get cancer, or you get divorced, or you get all these horrible things that happen, mysteriously, somehow, God is still protecting you and is still keeping you on the way to heaven. Even in the awful things, he's for you. So you have real security, not just some sort of fake security. And finally, we have the joy of knowing God that transcends everything else. The John verse, you know, joy I give to you. You know, I can't quote it exactly, but he's basically saying, as I have joy, I give it now to you, to my disciples. And so just on the diagram, the second diagram over the page then, is a little sort of summary of what we've seen so far, the bottom diagram. In terms of my experience of the gospel, that bottom triangle, bottom left of the top diagram, in relation to God, the curse makes me feel guilty, so we all feel guilty because we've done wrong. The gospel offers me peace and a clear conscience. In relation to the world, the curse makes me feel threatened by the world around me, insecure. The gospel, God offers me security, freedom from fear. And in relation to myself, the curse takes away my joy, turns me into an idolater, someone who lacks fulfillment. In the gospel, God promises me fullness of joy. So those, if you like, are three emotional, for want of a better word, promises I get offered in the gospel. Peace, security, and joy. So just before we do the little discussion, the obvious point in terms of idols is they therefore come along and offer exactly the same thing. Someone who's living for money, the little idol of money, says, look, I'm the true God, and you'll only be doing good, you'll only be doing well if you live for me, you know, hoard up me, collect loads of money. So I'll make you secure. If you want to be really secure in the world, God can't do that. You need a big bank balance. As long as you've got enough money, then you'll be safe. You'll be able to handle whatever the world throws at you. Money is what gives you security in this world. And money also says, look, I'll also make you happy. You can't be happy if you're poor. You can't be happy if you give your money to missionaries and you know, tithe away to church and whatever else you know, Christ is telling you to do with your money. That won't make you happy. What will make you happy is having loads of money and all the stuff that I can buy for you. So these false gospels, these false gods, promise exactly these three same things. A sense that you're doing right, a sort of calmed conscience, security, and joy. They're parasitic on the gospel. Bit of a gallop. we'll do some discussion. Hopefully the discussion is a bit of a recap and trying to piece together that. Any questions, though, just by way of clarification so far? No? probably easier to look at some of the verses. Let's try the John one. Or Psalm 28:7, there's the first one. Oh, brilliant. That's what happens when you use a different version. The word joy isn't there. In the NIV, I think is it in the NIV? In my heart rejoices. Right, leaps for joy. There you go. If you've got ESV, it then says exult. it's not talking about. It's not an exact synonym of happiness, because at times you will cry and you'll weep. Christ wept as he came into Jerusalem. He wept at Lazarus's grave. It's not talking about a sort of, I suppose, a false Christian, fake happiness that almost can't, almost in denial of wrong in the world and sin in the world and suffering in the world. So that's certainly important to distinguish the two. But I will struggle to define it, but it's a deep down satisfaction and... well, I can't think of a better word than joy, that we know God, and that he is the one that, I suppose, makes life worthwhile. He is the one who makes our hearts exult or leap with joy. Or he is the thing that most excites us, most satisfies us, most pleases us. It's a bit like in Ephesians, but it talks about the peace that transcends all understanding. And then someone says, well, what's that? And it kind of transcends. I don't know how you explain it. Over to anyone else. It's more than a shallow happiness or a surface happiness.
It's kind of like
Paul
talked about like having a contentment in spite of circumstances.
Yeah.
Your circumstances.
Yes. Yeah, certainly not based on circumstances, because circumstances will be a mess for now. But the other part of the gospel that we're not looking at sorts out the circumstances in years to come when Christ returns. But it's just a continual sort of promise. Joy, joy, joy comes up just hundreds of times. And I think I think one of the questions later on is which of these things do you struggle to experience the most? And for me, it would be joy, actually. I find it easy to get my head around God, working all things for good and knowing that I've got security in him, than I could honestly say that what most pleases me in life, most excites me, is him. That is less true for me. Okay.
Joy.
Yeah.
Well, if it's based on something much deeper and a kind of slightly different definition of joy, then I find it easier.
See what I mean? Yeah, I take greatest delight in something like that. It's hard. I suppose. No, that's helpful.
It's as much defined by what it isn't as what it is. That's the difficulty. So even if you think what the opposite of joy is, which would be so that kind of helps you understand the category. But yeah, to delight in will be, yes.
Mm.
You know, that's where you find your delight.
Mm.
Yeah. A contentment.
Yeah. You can be English and joyful. Just, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that verse in which down in John 15:11 is quite helpful, because that says, I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. So it's like Jesus was trying to get across that it's his inner peace and joy, knowing that he knows his Father so well.
Yeah.
Gives him such satisfaction that he wants to pass on to us.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's helpful. Okay, any more kind of clarification questions? Next question will probably get you thinking anyway, so. Okay, have a crack at the questions. See what you make of them. That first one's a line. It's a line from a novel, actually. The young man who rings the bell at the brothel is unconsciously looking for God. I showed this to James Buchanan earlier, and he said, "Do brothels have bells?" to which I had to say, "I don't know." I assume it's talking about doorbells. He was imagining some guy standing in the corner ringing a bell and getting confused. You get the point. The young man who goes to a brothel is unconsciously looking for God. How is that both true and false, given what we've talked about this evening? And what happens if we only focus on the false aspect, i.e., what happens if we only say to the guy who, you know, is constantly at the brothel, fornication is a hideous sin which will lead you to hell, Christ died for your sins, repent and believe. What happens if what are we missing if that's our only sort of way of presenting the gospel to him, true as it is? Go for it. Where are we? So the young man who rings the bell at the brothel is unconsciously looking for God. Okay, what's false about that to start with? Yep. Yeah, he's not. Sorry, that it's a sin and that he's not going to find God there. That if he was looking for God, he'd go to the Bible or he'd go to church or something. So, at a very obvious level, it's not true. He's substituting God. How is it true, though? Yeah. Other things to add to that? Yeah, potentially that one. I suppose that one would be the hard one to put into the thing. But certainly, he's wanting joy and pleasure and
I guess perhaps intimacy and relationship.
Yep. Yeah, that's a good point. With all these. I picked peace, joy, and security because I think they're three that most obviously relate to the three curses. But there's lots of other things you can go for as well. So what happens if we only focus on the false aspect? So if we only say to the sex addict, brothel crawler, whatever, it's wrong, God will get you for it, repent and believe. That's not untrue, but what's missing? Okay, yeah, so it's essentially you could say that second sentence to anybody, any time, any place. It's like a golden bullet. You're a sinner, Christ, you'll go to hell, but Christ died for you, repent and believe. Now, I want to be really clear, that's right, okay, those are true things. I'm not, and actually, if you're going to get it wrong by getting it right. Get it wrong by being clear. But it's not a very,
I just think it's helpful to learn how to actually, I suppose, communicate well with people, adapt to people's circumstances. So that's certainly one point, that it's not the best way of doing it, I'd argue, because, yeah, you're not taking into account that particular person. You're just treating him as a general sinner, not that particular person. Yep, very likely he's not likely to be the kind of person who has a particularly clear moral compass and be thinking in those kind of terms. So just develop that a bit further. So
you said it would just increase, if you were to say that, it would just push him further away.
It could do, yeah. Yeah. Especially if you go in like a steam train and just yell at him or something with a thunderboard. Yeah, it could do.
It has the potential to actually set this side, but I just don't understand that.
I think it's probably true in England that, yeah, those things, I mean, yeah. There's a sermon preached a good while ago, a couple of hundred years ago, just over, called The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. And Thomas Chalmers, he preached it. He said, look, if you're enslaved to an idol, there's two ways someone could speak to you. They could just say, stop it. Stop worshipping that god. Stop indulging in promiscuous sex. Stop drinking over the top. But the problem is, you're not replacing it with anything better. Tim's point. The only way to push out one affection, so one addiction, for want of a better word, is by putting something even better in its place. So it's like, I used to do quite a lot of youth work, and, I don't know, a teenage boy would be, he's a boy, he was usually girls, I'll be honest, was heartbroken because someone had ditched them, Sarah there was going to be the love of their life, he's a 14-year-old boy, it's awful, I'll never get over it, she was wonderful, I can't live without her, don't know what you said to him. You could say, look, Sarah's not that great, don't worry about it, you'll get over it. Emma comes along 4 weeks later, fine. Because something better than Sarah's come along. That's the only way you'd ever tear up. And that's just swapping one idol with another one, obviously. But with the gospel, we've got to present something better than what non-Christians are living for. First line of the Westminster Confession of Faith. Westminster Catechism, which we use. The question and answers we use. What is the chief end of man? What's the chief end of man? Hey, brilliant. That'll make Mark jealous. everyone knew Mark. Glorify God and enjoy Him forever. John Piper sort of changes it and he would argue clarifies it and says the chief end of man is to glorify God by enjoying Him forever. Either way, the point is there that it's not just do right, glorify God, that's your job, do it. It's actually you'll enjoy glorifying God. We're made for joy. You could do the same thing with security actually and the other things as well. This man at the brothel is looking for joy, and everybody's looking for joy. A bit like everybody's looking for security, and everyone's looking for peace, kind of clear conscience. What we've got to do is outdo them with the gospel, not present the gospel as something completely different. So, by the way, this is going to be a poor analogy, I'm afraid, but I'll go with it anyway. Imagine a man who just loves cabbages, okay, just addicted to cabbages, and you're desperately trying to persuade him to stop being addicted to these cabbages. Now, if you come along and say, look, I'll swap that cabbage that you've got there, I'll swap it for a football. Okay? I don't want to swap it for football. I like cabbages. Cabbages, well, I'm hungry, I like eating, I like cabbages. What good's a football? If you come along and say, hey, I'll swap your cabbage for a five-course banquet, well, that's a different offer, isn't it, to the football? You see how it's different? You're offering him something that's far better, but in the same line as he was going for to begin with. Football's just something completely different. But five-course banquet, well, yeah, that's a cabbage supersized. Okay? That's how I should have done it. You're offering someone a Big Mac, Dave, and then you offer them a king-size Big Mac. Okay? It's the same sort of... Speak your language. It's that offer. When you offer someone the gospel, you're offering them a banquet, not a football. Okay? That's the picture. I told you it was going to be bad. Good. Right.
just over the page, and we'll polish off.
So in terms of how we respond to people then, a friend of mine, Dan Strange, these are his titles, I've pinched them. He talks about showing up idols and showing off the gospel. Showing up idols and showing off the gospel. We're going to do show up next week, so we'll leave that for now. So show off. The process of showing off that God is actually better than idols. It's exactly what we've literally just been talking about. And it happens, I think this is helpful, it happens through our lifestyle as well as our words. So we're to be a light to the Gentiles, constantly told that in the Bible, aren't we? In word and in deed. And don't underestimate the effect living a real God-centred, Christ-centred life has on those around you. And of course it's only magnified by them being able to explain why you're living like that. So the question really is, with these three key emotions I've argued that everybody craves, is can we demonstrate in our life a real sense of peace, a real sense of security, and a real sense of joy? Because that is what the world is craving for and desperately trying to find by being rich or by being popular or by being beautiful or being successful, but can't ever quite get there. And it's obviously particularly effective in situations where naturally the world would say you shouldn't be peaceful or you shouldn't be secure or you shouldn't be joyful. So some examples, you know, you lose your job. You know, you and your mate get made redundant at the moment. Everybody's panicking, and yet somehow you remain calm and secure. Well, you're demonstrating that your real security comes from God, who's your heavenly Father, who's promised that in all things he'll work together for your good. Or who's, you know, Matthew passage is about, you know, why do you worry? Do not worry. Or you're single, and you're not out trying to sleep with every girl you can on Friday night. Your friends, who are enslaved to lust, as they see it as the only source of joy, are going to begin to wonder, what, you know, what's going on? Why is he not trying to sort of grab anyone he can? Well, you're demonstrating that your joy is in God, not in lust or sex or whatever. And hopefully, with prayer, obviously, that'll lead to opportunities to then actually speak, explain why you live this way. And it's not, I think this kind of links in slightly with Janet's sort of question earlier on joy. It's not that we have to be falsely pious or sort of superhuman or fake, basically. It's just that life situations are usually good bridges. So if you imagine two girls chatting over a coffee break about their respective lack of success with men, Christian and non-Christian. So the Christian, yeah, I'd like to find a husband to settle down with, but, you know, it's not the most important thing in the world. Non-Christian, really? Pretty much is. I realise these are fake conversations, so, you know. But you get the point. Christian, well, you know, yeah, I'd like to get married, don't get me wrong, but I suppose I just mean that I'm not relying on it as the only thing that's going to make me happy. Who knows whether it will happen? I hope so. But if not, I can honestly say that I'm happy. Non-Christian, well, that's good, I suppose, but do you really not mind staying single? Christian, doesn't have to be fake, I do at times, don't get me wrong, but if you don't mind me saying, look, being a Christian makes a huge difference. Experience of knowing God, or the joy of knowing God, or whatever, more than makes up for not having a husband. That's, you know, well, there you go, last paragraph. What I'm keen to get across is that even though in that conversation the person hadn't said, and by the way, you know you're single, and upset about that, that's only the start of it. You're going to hell. That hasn't happened, but, and she hasn't emphasised penal substitution, but she still had an evangelistic conversation, okay? She's, the gospel has experiential aspects, experience aspects to it, is what I'm saying. And I think they're some of the easiest bridgeheads to begin conversations. Now, that's not the end of it. That conversation is not enough for that non-Christian girl to become a Christian. Don't mishear me. At some point, of course, she needs to understand the cross and other stuff. But it's a bridgehead. And you are demonstrating these gospel blessings, what the gospel offers, in the way you live and in the way you speak. Basically, I suppose in summary, what we need to do is out rejoice the world, out, I don't know, there's no verb for this, out secure the world, whatever the word is, and sort of out peace the world. It's trumping the gospels, the idols, not just slating them from a distance. Okay, that's all from me. We'll do this last discussion, but again, any final questions, comments, additions, and all the rest. good.
Great. Well, just
I suggest you maybe do 10 minutes of discussion, and then pray for 20 minutes. I'll talk through the questions. I know sometimes I write questions, then everyone hasn't got a clue what I mean. So I'll stop me when they don't make sense. Clearly, to show off the gospel, we need to really believe it. Okay, so which aspects of the experience of the gospel, i.e., that we have complete peace of conscience, complete security, and complete joy? Those are the three we looked at tonight. Which of those do you find it hardest to actually believe? What idols do you believe will meet those three needs better than Jesus? If that's too personal, you don't want to discuss it with the people on the table, you can switch it to where does the media or the world around us teach our children to look for peace, security and joy? Where do you have the best opportunity to show that you have got peace, security and joy different from the world? Okay, so where in your life situation are those the most sort of striking to those around you? And if you get time, granted that we haven't yet looked at this, how to show up idols, i.e. how to show they're false, try and craft an example from what we've looked at tonight about how you might explain the gospel to someone who idolised family, idolised Allah, if you know anything about Islam, idolised career success, or you can make up your own. Happy? Great.